Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Are you ready?
Thumbs up.
Guys, Aaron Goff is here. You kidding me? The man, the myth, the legend. He's here. First things first, this is the Full Blast Podcast, and I'm Jeff Fader. And before we get into it with Aaron, we got a lot to cover. We're going to take care of a little business. First things first, Broadbeck Ironworks, makers of the 2x72 grinder. This is an awesome grinder, and they have great attachments, and they have great deals, and they have great parts to make your grinder better. And if you have another grinder and you're thinking to yourself, well, I don't need the attachments, well, these attachments are retrofittable with whatever you got. So go to broadbeckironworks.com, put in the promo code KNIFETALK10 for 10% off all your stuff. Next are my friends at Even Heat, manufacturers of the finest heat treat ovens available. To find your next oven, go to evenheat-kiln.com. Got to get that tap control, solid state drive. I'm heat treating all my stainless in it, all my Baker Forge steel, all my exotic steels, and I'm even drying out my wood for stabilizing, and I'm setting my stabilizing with the Even Heat. So it's really versatile. It keeps my temperature correct, and it ain't got much better than that. Next are my friends at Maritime Knife Supply. MaritimeKnifeSupply.com for all your knife making needs, belts, abrasives, steels, kilns, forges, press, heat treating ovens, all that stuff. Support, and I've been talking about it. We're probably going to talk a little bit about it this episode, and we have been talking about it on Knife Talk, but Maritime Knife Supply is trying to figure out ways in which they can ship a lot of their products to the United States. The United States is, we've taken away the $800 de minimis exemption, which makes it harder and harder for people to ship into the United States products that the country of origin is not Canada, United States, or Mexico. So we're working on that. But in the meantime, there is stuff available on their website, and you should definitely support them. Lawrence Lake is very involved with the New England School of Metalwork, very involved with the Center for Metal Arts, and he's helping you. And I think that if you're an American especially, you should definitely support him how you can. And if you're in Canada, I mean, stop playing. I mean, what are you doing? He's the best. Ain't no much better than Lawrence Lake at MaritimeKnifeSupply.com. And if you get a 10-pack of abrasive belts, you get 10% off. And P.S., he's got the best prices and products. He's a knife maker. He knows what you need. So support our guy. And as things improve or things change, we'll keep you abreast of it. But definitely go support Maritime Knife Supply however you can. Next are my friends at Trojan Horse Forge, makers of the Stabilo Knife Finishing Vice, makers of the T4 Sentinel Oil, makers of knives, teachers of classes. Definitely, definitely, definitely go to TrojanHorseForge.com, see what they have to offer. And when you get one of their Stabilo Knife Finishing Vices or the T4 Sentinel Oil, you put in the promo code FULLBLAST10, you get 10% off. So, and what's better than that? I don't know. I mean, you can't beat that. Speaking of great products, my guys at Baker Forge, BakerForge.com, Baker Forge and Tool on Instagram are the makers of this beautiful, beautiful exotic steels. copper Maya, bronze Maya, all that really, really kind of exotic stuff with layers and cores and, you know, all this great stuff. It shouldn't be intimidating if you're a stock removal person, because it's all comes annealed. They kind of hold your hand getting it ground and heat treated. And I'm telling you this, all that copper Maya, it's like super easy, because you can see where the core is because the copper sticks out while you're grinding it. You don't need to dip it in that gator piss. So definitely go to BakerForge.com and then put in the promo code FULLBLAST. You get 10% off. And then when you're heat treating and you're tempering and you're finishing it all off and you got to grind it and you're ready to dip it, you dip in that gator piss, G-A-T-O-R-P-I-S-S. Gator short for alligator, piss is short for urine. This is the best etching on the market. And funny enough, I got a message from one of our listeners saying that they were wearing a gator piss shirt out at a gas station or something like that. And some old hillbilly fogey says, "Gator piss, what's that?" And the only thing he said was, "Gator short for alligator, piss short for urine." Ain't much better than that. And thank God, because that must have really flustered the dude. And hopefully, if you talk to Coy, we'll be making some gator short for alligator, piss short for urine t-shirts. I mean, we'll find out. I mean, I don't know what's wrong with me, but I think it'd be funny, and he does too. So we'll see. Keep your eyes out on that, and when we do have them, we'll let you know. So definitely get yourself some of that gator piss, and you can also get it at Texas Ferry Supply. Texas Ferry Supply is a great service. They supply knife makers, farriers, blacksmiths. They have all the stuff you need, and when you go to checkout, I get my rhino wet there, P.S., you can get 10% off when you put in the promo code KNIFETALK10. And all the codes are in the show notes wherever you're listening to this. So many thanks to them, and many thanks to Coy and the guys. They're hilarious. So let's get them T-shirts made, Coy. I mean, come on. Yeah, gator short for alligator, piss is short for urine, gator piss. Next, my friends at Total Boat, I just got a pile of stuff from Total Boat. I am like, I love this stuff. The Fathom is great. They don't even call it Fathom Thick Set anymore. It's Fathom Epoxy. It's deep resin. It's super easy to use. I made some handle hybrid material and I'm really amazed with it. I was asked about whether or not, well, do you get bubbles? You need a pressure pot. I found out that I talked to Kristen Brown, who's fantastic, and she said the reason why you don't get bubbles is because it's very slow curing and it's very thin. So there are no bubbles because the bubbles kind of float out. So definitely, definitely go get yourself some Total Boat. I use the two-part epoxy. I love the two-part epoxy. They just sent me a dispenser. This thing is like super slick. It's like I'm a barista for epoxy now. It's awesome. Their UV cure resin is really great. Their high-performance epoxy is great. Their CA glue is really good. So go to totalboat.com/fullblast. And if you're at Maker Camp, I will be doing a demo with them Saturday. And then Sunday, we're going to be making some handle scales. So definitely check out that. And many thanks to Total Boat, obviously. I also want to thank my friends at GL Hansen & Sons. It's g.l.hansen&sons. You go to gcarded.bigcartel for all of their beautiful, unique composites of natural fibers and fabrics mixed under epoxy and pressure with heat, creating beautiful scales. They sent me a pile of stuff. I just put some offset serrateds up on the website with some of their trout. Their trout colors are really cool, Mexican blanket and all that stuff. So definitely go to gcarter.bigcartel.com. It's super easy to work with, and it really has a lot of razzle-dazzle. And the amazing thing is my customers are starting to ask for it by name. So definitely go to gcarter.bigcartel.com to see what the hoopla is about. See what the hoopla is about. They have a set of scales called Hoopla. Hoopla might be the best. So see what the hoopla is all about. Next thing you know is I want to thank my friends at Tormek, celebrating 50 years of plus of being in business with the Black TA sharpening system. I love the Tormek. I sharpen all my knives on the Tormek. I found that when you use I know a lot of knife makers use their grinders with the slack belt and they think it's faster. The other thing is you're going to get a lot of undercut, meaning all of a sudden the radius of your blade is going to look a little bit thinner on the heel. And a lot of it's because of the way you hold it on a slack belt. I found that using the Tormek has made me much more efficient in terms of taking the right amount of material off and safely. And it's a game changer for me. And it has showed me that I could push my geometry a lot better. So I'm going to Tormek.com, and the guys at Tormek are going to come down to the shop at some point, and we'll talk about that. Oh, Carl, and who knows, maybe Jack will be here. I don't think Jack will be here. Jack too busy doing something else. Many thanks to Tormek, and I want to thank my friends at Nordic Edge. If you're in Australia, and you're listening to this and you're saying, I want to get all these tools and I want to do all the stuff that Aaron Goff is doing because he's the man. Well, here's the problem. You might want to take a class to see if this is for you. Otherwise, you know, somebody's going to be mad because they're going to, the truck's going to pull up with all of this equipment and you don't know what the hell you're doing. You can go to nordicedge.com.au or nordic_edge on Instagram, and then they'll teach you classes. They have, not only do they supply products, but they teach blacksmithing, leatherworking, spoon carving, knife making, all those classes. And then you can say, hey, this is for me, or hey, maybe I should just take more classes and decide if it's for me. So many thanks to Nordic Edge. They have the guidance to help accelerate your creativity and the tools, products, and supplies to help you manifest your ideas. nordicedge.com.au. And last but certainly not least, I want to thank my friends at Phoenix Abrasives, phoenixabrasives.com. Phoenix Abrasives supplies superior abrasive products for every application, knife making, metal fabrication, glass fabrication, floor sanding, and crankshaft. I don't know what that is, but I think it's something. So get your belts, get your grinding, get your cutting disc, your flap disc, surface belt, your surface conditioning stuff. And you go to check it out. You're going to go check out all the stuff they have. Tons of different products. I'm amazed at how much stuff they have. And then when I go to checkout, go to FB, put in FB10 at checkout. You're going to get 10% off your order. So many thanks to Phoenix Abrasives. Many thanks to all my sponsors. I really appreciate it. I have a really nice relationship with all of them. And, you know, I'm definitely appreciative. But who I'm really appreciative for is my man. My man is back. Aaron Goff is, in my opinion, the godfather of modern day knife making internet education. And I think that his videos, if you've gone on YouTube and you've gone to Goff Customs on YouTube, you will find the most efficient and well done educational videos on how to make knives. And he's really helped a ton of people, including me. Aaron Goff is my man. How are you?
I'm not too bad. Thank you, sir.
Dude, it's good to hear your voice.
It's good to be heard. It's been, honestly, a while since we recorded a pod, eh?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I try to get people on. I try to have my guys every so often. And then, we were going to do one a few months ago, and then you had a major power outage.
It wasn't just a power outage, yeah. It was fun. It was wild. It was a little dangerous. We had an ice storm at our place that coated, every surface in an inch of ice. We ended up having about 50% of the trees in our area, collapse, and have to get taken down. Standing outside during it, it just sounded like incoming artillery fire or something, cracking.
Wind chimes.
Yeah, it was crazy. So anyway, we ended up having no power, no water, no cell service or internet for 10 days.
10 days?
10 days.
So did pipes freeze or...
No. Like we're pretty well set up for this. We live in the middle of nowhere, so we have a little tiny generator. I actually threw up a bunch of solar panels, hooked them up to little batteries, and kept our furnace running, which runs on propane. We drove into a nearest town that had a disaster center because everyone was having the same problems, and we were literally driving cars full of water back to our house.
Oh my god!
Yeah, it was I don't know, kind of fun.
Ugh. I don't find that fun at all. When I was a kid, there was a snowstorm in October, and it dumped, and I was not in the city. I was outside at this person's house. Mm-hmm. It dumped 6 feet of snow.
Oh.
And in October, so no one was prepared for it at all. We were locked in to this house for 3 days, and it was this is terrible. I was a kid, and I was like, this is terrible. It was fun for 5 minutes, and then it was fun when you find out you missed a day of school, but then it was just locked into this place is no good.
Well, honestly, for me, it was a little bit of a reset. It was all of a sudden I'm fixing stuff outside. I have to drive somewhere to work. I work remote, right? But
yeah.
One of the local businesses had Starlink, so that was still working. So I'd drive there and work during the day. I couldn't do any workshop stuff, so I just come home and read a book. It was... kind of nice. It's kind of chill.
The not using the internet sometimes is really great.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? I'm a technology boy, but I can lean in on that, I think.
You can lean on not using technology?
Yeah. The internet hasn't become the thing that I dreamed it would be when I was a kid.
Really?
No. When I was growing up, everyone was wow, it's the information superhighway. Everyone's going to have this democratized access to information. We're all going to, you know, learn the best things. We as a civilization are going to get better. And instead, it's just full of lies and advertising.
All right, I'm going to say internet really started to kind of move the needle. Started to develop 1996. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember graduating from college. Yep. When I was in college in 1996, I graduated in 1996. There was a email system called the VAX on our campus. It was brand new, and then you could send mm-hmm. emails to everybody, and you could do what's referred to as an all-stew, and which is means like you could, you know, you put everybody who's, you know, in the school in the ledger, and it was like a big thing. People would get drunk and do all-stews to, you know, all-stools, all fat. You know, it was hilarious. I remember the internet really, you know, being talked about around 1996. Mm. My experience, so I'm at 1996, so I'm like 23 or something like that. My experience was I felt as though we didn't really understand. I was old enough that we thought maybe this is a fad. Mm. Like, we didn't necessarily take advantage of the opportunities that were going to come from it. Because at the time, it was people just making websites. But there was no real way to kind of use those websites for much of anything anyway.
I miss those old websites. People just doing wacky projects, you know, and putting them up on a website, or you have some website that's, you know, ABC dot, you know, BerkeleyU.gov or whatever, and the professors would be putting their projects up there and stuff. Like, I don't know. It was just such a fun and individualistic time on the internet, and now everything gets filtered through businesses that are taking a cut, you know.
Well, that's the weirdest part. And speaking of which, I could have been a millionaire by now. I had the best name. I had the best email or website. My first website, 1996. A friend of mine made me a website for, you know, I make these sculptures, these giant fishing lures. I've been doing it since, you know, for 30 years. He got me biglures.com. And I had biglures.com. for maybe 3 or 4 years, and nothing really happened with it. I mean, nothing really happened. Right. Unless he gave it away. But I think to myself now, if I had biglures.com, I would be like, I'd get sell it to like Bass Pro Shops or Cabela's, and I'd be like living.
Well, someone has golf.com, and they keep trying to sell it to me for like 14 grand or something. You know, like they're just squatting on this domain that they have like no personal attachment to.
That's a fucking weird flex. That's like a weird business move.
It's the whole thing. Like, it's literally called domain squatting. They'll just buy up like hundreds and hundreds of names, you know, whatever's available, and then try to, you know, essentially auction them off to other people. Like, theoretically, I think there's some ways around it. Like, if they're squatting on like your personal name or like your business name, you can be like, actually, you don't have the rights to that, you know.
Yeah,
but no one wants to fight that battle.
I think that for me, I mean, I see social media as almost different from the internet, because it's because it's like when the internet first started out, the concept of social media didn't really exist. It wasn't really a way for people to kind of interact very quickly and be, you know, easy access. I think that a lot of it had to do with the accessibility of, I think that, I would imagine, you tell me, that smartphones were really the bridge between interface with the internet and social media. Because, I mean, what are you going to do? I remember the days of having to get a disc reader and uploading your pictures from your digital camera.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, no one's going to do that. That's like too much work.
Oh, maybe it should be that much work. Maybe we should go back. I see. I never ever thought that I would be like sounding like a Luddite, but here I am, you know, full-time software engineer, part-time knife maker and CNC machinist, and I guess I'm a Luddite now.
Well, you're jaded. You've always been, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you've always been, you were the first person to, you were on the podcast a number of years ago, and we were talking about AI, and you were saying, well, AI, this is, and you've kind of sculpted the way I think about, you know, AI. And you said, well, it's not really artificial intelligence. It's deep learning software. Yep. And the deep learning software just, you know, learns as it goes, and then it adjusts. You can't really see it as like a sentient thing.
No. I mean, a lot of people are trying to change that, for better or for worse. A lot of people are dumping a lot of money into trying to change that. I'm unsure if that's a good thing or not. I think really whether it's a good thing or not, it's going to come down to how do we access that? You know, is it, do we have democratic free access to that, or is it filtered through corporations that want to take a slice? You know, and I think it's going to be the latter, unfortunately.
What do you see as, since social media and the internet, since you were a kid and you thought this is going to make everything better, what have you seen in regards to how we are now? You know, how do you see that at like the fork in the road of, you were like expecting this kind of, you were thinking that this is going to be this incredible world of education and meritocracy and, you know, every democracy for, democracy for information and education and intelligence. And it took a steep turn.
I think
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. You bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Out of it, at least, is that, like, I remember being in high school and everyone, you know, teachers saying you can't use Wikipedia as a source. You know, right. It's full of lies, right? Like, don't trust what you read on there. And now everyone's just trusting whatever, you know, so-and-so says on Facebook. Like, that's become the new, I read it on Facebook. Must be true. I think that it's very difficult for a lot of people who end up in, like, an algorithmic bubble. You know, they're always being shown the same thing. It's very hard to discern objective truth in that situation. So I think that's super dangerous, unfortunately.
How has your job changed? I know we're going to talk about Golf Customs, but I know that you've kind of like really leaned into your computer programming. How has that changed over the years, especially now that it seems as though it's everything is moving kind of in an exponential rate?
Yeah, like the tech industry is interesting. Like, if you don't keep up with what's happening, then you very quickly get left behind. Like, a lot of user interface stuff within the browser is written in a language called JavaScript. And, over the last like 10 years, that industry, or like that language and the frameworks in the language to help you build user interfaces, has moved so quickly that you would be like rewriting your project in a new kind of language every year or something.
Wow.
And if you didn't keep up with that, your knowledge would very quickly become out of date. And I see the same stuff happening with AI in programming now. So, like, I use AI multiple times every day. It's integrated with my code editor. So it'll try, I'll start writing something. It'll try to anticipate what I'm going to write based on the rest of the file that I'm working in, that kind of thing. And then it'll autocomplete. And it's gone from being kind of a novel hindrance, it's right sometimes, but like most of the time it's giving me these wacky suggestions. It's gone from that to like, it just knows how to copy my style, and it's genuinely useful. And that is like the lowest level of AI integration that an employer would expect a software engineer to understand at this point.
That actually brings me to the question that for the listeners, I talk about, I use Siri on my phone to, usually find out sports scores. Or like last night, I was watching. We were watching the championships of the U.S. Open, and I wanted to know. Hillary, my wife, asked me how old, you know, Alcaraz is. You know, so it's like I'm not even going to bother typing in. I'm just going to, you know.
Hey, what Siri,
can you tell me and the listeners, you know, who a lot of them say I don't use AI. Mm-hmm. What's the what is the least amount of AI used that people wouldn't even realize that it's being used? Is it that like the when you're typing and then it just assumes what you're, it just kind of anticipates? Is that the lowest level of the use of AI?
That, like, so you're talking about like, oh, you start typing in Google a request and it guesses what you're going to say. That, right. That's just quote unquote autocomplete. You know, like it's.
And that's not even AI.
No, it's just matching the words that you've already written with, you know, what other people have written. Lowest. I mean, this. Okay, so we have to differentiate again between AI and machine learning. So machine learning is like the larger umbrella. Artificial intelligence is kind of the ongoing quest for sentience, you know, for true artificial intelligence. But there's a lot of different points in that spectrum. So like if you take your smartphone and you turn on the camera and you point at a group of people, there'll be those little boxes that go around people's faces.
Yeah.
That's a machine learning algorithm that has been taught to recognize faces and to give the camera information so it can focus on them. You know, that might be my tiniest example.
And do you think that people don't realize, most people don't realize how much AI is kind of integrated into all things using a computer?
I mean, I didn't even realize until like a year ago. The field has been moving so rapidly that even those of us that are like trying to keep up with it on a daily basis are constantly like, new stuff. It is moving at an unbelievable pace at the moment.
So did we make a mistake with what was it when there was going to be a time in life, this was supposed to be like 10 years ago, where computers and man merged and there was the singularity.
The singularity.
Was the singularity off by like 10 years? The singularity was, what was his name again?
It's probably Ray Kurzweil.
Ray Kurzweil thought that it was going to be a moment in time. I think it was like early, I don't remember, it was like maybe the mid 2000 teens or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he said that there was going to be a moment in time where we reach a singularity where technology and humanity merge, and there's going to be such an exponential growth in technology that humanity can't keep up with it. Something like that.
I mean,
are we late? Was he just, his prediction just like 10 years off?
Well, yeah, all those predictions are. Just like nuclear fusion is going to be with us in 30 years, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it'll be off until suddenly it's here. Someone will make that little breakthrough and then like, oh, no, it's here. We all have to get used to this new reality. And I think it's going to be very similar for the singularity. Like, so there's this test called the Turing test where you have a blind conversation with another person. Or it could be a computer. And your job as you know, an adjudicator of this test is to discern, like, is the person on the other end of this conversation a human or a computer? And that used to be the gold standard for, like, does AI pass the Turing test? And we don't even talk about that anymore. Like, every AI application, like, every... So I'm going to be more specific. Every large language model, you know, so that's ChatGPT, that's Gemini, that's Claude... all of those passed the Turing test. Like, we blew past that, and then people just stopped even talking about it. So I think it's going to be something similar to that, and it's just going to happen.
So does this make your job infinitely harder because you're constantly having to be, you know, are you worried about your relevance in, you know, obviously you're a very intelligent person, you're smart, you're very well thought out and all this, and you're prepared. Do you worry about your job?
I did. A little bit. And, you know, so I was actually asked at my company, they were like, hey, do you want to give a talk about AI? And I was like, hell yeah. And then I showed the first draft of it to someone and they were like, hey man, I think this might be a little dark. Like, people are scared of AI and I don't think this is going to help. And I was like, yeah, that sounds about right. Because at that period in time, the way I described it was, I see a train coming and I either get to be on the train or in front of the train and I have to make a choice. And I chose to be on the train. So I really dug in and I spent probably like 8 months every day researching, like learning, you know, how does a large language model work internally at the very low levels? Like, how can I make use of them in my own code, in my own applications? And at this point, I'm not worried. But before I had that knowledge, I was worried. And I think that if software engineers don't keep up with the field and stay relevant, then yeah, they should be worried.
I've been talking about this on Knife Talk and on here for with a lot of like creative people. And part of me has been worried about people losing jobs back in the day. I've said this a million times. I'm going to say it one more time. When I was a kid, my dad and I, not that I wasn't that, I was, you know, obviously probably a late teenager. I was driving the car with my dad and they started talking about Easy Pass, which was this thing that you'd put on your car and then you drive through a toll and you wouldn't have to open your window to give change, proper change to the toll booth collector.
Right.
And I remember thinking, I said, boy, this seems like it's going to kind of take over. And my dad says, yeah, it does look like it's going to take over. And I said, well, what are all the, because, you know, you're driving, it's back in the 80s, you're driving through every toll booth. There's like, you know, sometimes there's, you can imagine that there's always somebody at the toll booth, and you'd imagine all over the country there's toll booth operators and there's shifts and there's 24-hour service. And and I thought to myself, well, what are these people going to do for a job? And my dad said, they're going to have to find a new job. And now we're at that point where there are no toll booths, zero. I mean, maybe if you're in some, you know, maybe in some, you know, place where they've just kind of given up. And then, you know, as technology goes on now, used to be back in our, you know, at our Home Depot in town when I moved here 20 years ago, there was an influx of small businesses closing their doors. And then the people who worked at those small businesses and own those small businesses, or who were plumbers or electricians, they would get a job at the Home Depot. And you could see people that you knew who had small businesses, and then they would end up at the Home Depot because Home Depot took over their business. And the next thing you know, they're asking them to do their jobs. Now that they're because of self-checkout, because of all this information, there's fewer and fewer jobs at the Home Depot where I thought, all right, well, at least somebody got a job. Yep. I'm convinced that these lower tiered, or I mean, I don't want to say uneducated, but I want to say these jobs that normal people would have. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't mean to say uneducated. Strike that from the record. You know, regular jobs that people could get, summer jobs that kids could get, and I feel as though almost everything is going away with technology. I don't know how we're going to be able to handle, you know, the job world with the way technology is going.
Yep. Yeah, and you know, so I have a question for you.
Go ahead.
Do you think that having someone sit in a toll booth and, you know, take coins and count change, like, is that a worthwhile thing for a human to be doing?
That's a great question, because it's an interesting question, and I love that question, because it's like, should the employer go to this toll booth person and said, shouldn't you go back to school? I mean, who's to say?
I don't even think that. So like,
it's like a question of, is this the right moral dilemma?
Yeah.
Like who are you to say?
I don't know. For me, the way that we live right now, honestly, seems kind of cold in a lot of ways. Like, if you, you know, let's say you grow up with some, you know, physical malformation that makes work hard, you know, your life's just hard now. Like, you didn't do anything to earn that. But the way that our society is built, you know, work and valuable output basically equals like the right to have a nice life. And I think that value judgment is going to really come into the spotlight as more and more people discover that, you know, technology can do their job faster. And I think, like, we as a civilization are going to have to face, are we going to face that situation with compassion? And we're going to say, like, no, you're here. You deserve to live. Or are we going to say, like, well, you don't serve any purpose. Just go die, you know? I think that is going to be one of the most painful kind of moments in our history. I think that's like, you know, the industrial age all over again, but worse.
Cause I mean, you think about it, like, and I really like that question. You think about it, like if the profession of toll booth taker is gone, It's got to go somewhere. These people got to go somewhere. So then as technology kind of like makes certain businesses go away, there's all of a sudden there's this displacement of humanity of like, all right, well, you know, all of a sudden the job market is much, you know, it's a bigger pool, right? Yeah. And then there's going to be more disparity.
Well, and you know, like there's one single example. We may have talked about this on the pod before, but like I really like this example, which is, you know, there's so many companies working on self-driving cars. Everyone wants to be the company that, you know, nails self-driving cars. And once you have self-driving cars, then self-driving trucks aren't hard. That means that deliveries and stuff can get automated. But transport is, if I remember correctly, transportation is like 30% of the US job market. So wow. All
that's
of a sudden,
way more than expected.
Yeah. You know, like truck drivers, taxi drivers, you know, delivery drivers, postal workers, you know, there's a huge segment of our labor industry that just involves driving a vehicle around. What do we do as a civilization when that's not necessary anymore? You know, it's going to happen. We have to face up to that. And yet very few, I think, like political entities are talking about that.
Yeah. And, you know, even my wife tells me she's a nurse practitioner. Mm-hmm. And I remember back when she started to become a nurse practitioner, she said that what's happening now is nurse practitioners can prescribe medication the way a doctor can. So what's right. happening is hospitals were investing more into nurse practitioners because they could see more patients, prescribe mm-hmm. more like a doctor, and they're cheaper than having doctors. So there was this huge influx of nurse practitioners and then hiring less doctors. Now, you know, no one's going to cry for a doctor, but at the same time, the writing was on the wall that they're figuring out ways in which to eliminate higher paying jobs. And this is just a manifestation of that, in my opinion.
Right.
But, we get this, you know, you're talking about this kind of stuff all the time. And what's the interesting thing about you as a knife maker and me as a knife maker and or sculptors or artists or people who are making something is you have this ability to focus your business on something that is not vanilla, nobody. There's no face to it. There's no nothing. You mm-hmm. have this ability to create something that AI can't do, which is sign a business that has some creativity, that has some, you know, personal reflection, that has some purpose, and then it has the face of a person doing it. And then right. you're creating this brand based off of you that can't really be replicated.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
I don't know.
That sounded yeah, terrible, dude.
Yeah.
That sounded horrible.
Well, I don't know if you've heard that there are people that are, you know, I'm sure you've heard of OnlyFans, Jeff.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you know that there are OnlyFans, I don't know what the term is, like presenters, OnlyFans personalities that are entirely AI?
I did work on this. Yes, I did it. Yeah. I have weird news up the wazoo. And I do know that there are, I do know this.
You know, so when you talk about like a brand that is personalized and it's a person, you know, like, You're literally talking about a naked person here. They are their own brand, and yet they don't exist. Like,
right.
What? What the heck? If you'd asked me, like, hey, what kind of industry do you think is safe from AI? I would have been like, well, sex work seems pretty safe. Nope.
Dude, that brings me right into a weird news story. I got weird news right off the bat. We're gonna break into weird news stories just because I have, and here's your choice based on what you're saying. There's a AI controversy shuts down amid the scientists found something dark about people with AI girlfriends and boyfriends, and then AI chat box are having conversations with minors that would land a human in sex offender registry, and AI companion app shuts down amid controversy. So.
Yeah. You know, and like, I don't know what to say about this, man, honestly, because like, I've had hard days where I'm like, hey, ChatGPT, like, help me talk through this problem, you know?
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. And in some ways, that could be seen as therapy, right? Where does it become unhealthy? Like, what's the line where it becomes unhealthy? Is it unhealthy when like your primary interaction is with an AI, or am I already doing an unhealthy thing and just asking for advice. You know?
This one comes from the Futurist. Over the past few years, there have been some more and more stories, some sad and strange, about people falling in love and lust with so-called AI companions. Mm-hmm. As AI tools grow more sophisticated and gain more mainstream acceptance, so too have the interest in these digital paramours increased. In a new study published in the Journal of Social and Personal Relationships, researchers from Brigham Young University found that not only that enormous numbers of people are engaging with AI companions, but many seem to be more depressed and lonely than those that don't.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, is that correlation or is that causation? Like, are they talking to the AI companion because the rest of their life is very empty and they don't have any other outlets? You know, and therefore they're more likely to be depressed? Or are they, you know, with all other factors aside, they're starting to talk to an AI and then they get more depressed?
Through these technologies, especially AI companions, are marketed to help lonely people feel more connected. Mm-hmm. The Brigham Young University relationship researchers in their first found evidence suggesting links between AI use and depression and loneliness. While the direction of this association is unclear, we found no evidence that AI is helping people feel less alone or isolated.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, okay, so let's fast forward a little bit. If we get to the point where, you know, I've said this before on the pod, like right now, artificial intelligence, it's not, as far as I'm aware, it's not sentient. You know, it's not having genuine feelings about your conversation. It's not, you know, thinking about you when you're not talking to it. It's very transactional, right? Like, it's either there or it isn't. What happens when those AIs actually become, you know, cross that boundary, become more sentient? Is, you know, like, you're kind of just talking to another form of life at that point. And is that okay? Like, would that be, you know, someone has an AI companion, like a Tamagotchi, but it's like a real intelligence in there.
Right. Well, weirder things have happened. And last week we had an article about a woman had a marriage ceremony where she got married to a tree. So, you know, I mean, we're going to also have to like delineate between just like, wackos have existed since day one to a large group of people are starting to marry trees. You know, I think that we need a little bit of, we need a little perspective in regards to the volume of people who are, you know, falling in love with these AI companions versus, you know, one or two recently, someone, you know, really hurt themselves. You know, it apparently there was a story of this kid who was really depressed and then the AI companion helped him, you know, kill himself. It's like,
right,
you know, I think that those are, it seems as though those are full and few and far between, but at the same time it is definitely brings up, you know, ethical dilemmas.
100%. And I mean, so like within programming we have this term for a rubber duck. So like basically I'm stuck on a problem, I need to talk it through with somebody, but until I've verified that I can't like fix it myself, it's kind of a waste of time if I'm just like, oh hey Bob, like come help me with this thing. So the first line of defense in that, in preventing like unnecessary interruptions, what we call rubber ducking, where you talk to an inanimate object. You get a little rubber duck toy and you just literally be like, here's my problem, I'm going to talk it through. And, you know, in a non-trivial amount of cases, like just the act of explaining it helps you reason about it better and, you know, you solve your problem. That's very much the way that I treat AI now, right? I'm not like, oh, I'm worried I'm going to hurt this thing's feelings or whatever. But, yeah, absent other outlets, I can totally see how people end up down that rabbit hole.
I'll tell you what I do was when I'm using Siri, I usually say thank you.
Yeah,
and right. I was when I was in Spain and I was using Siri, Tomer Botner, Florentine Kitchen Knives scolded me for saying thank you to Siri.
Right.
And he's just like, and he's just like, don't thank that robot. He's like, this is nothing. This can't be good.
Well,
okay, yeah, he's a smart guy. He has got a lot of opinions in regards to, you know, he's very, very, very well, you know, well informed in regards to AI and how it's going to help business. And he believes that like pretty soon his opinion is Google is going to go away and ChatGPT is going to be the way you're going to advertise. But right. He scolded me. And I said to him, like, I'm only saying thank you because I don't want to, I want to keep in practice of being polite. Because I don't see people as often as I used to. And I feel as though there's, you get this lack of discipline in regards to social behaviors. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed over the years people losing a degree of politeness. And just because I'm more concerned that I'm going to fall within the confines of all of a sudden I'm going to lose my human politeness. So I thank her just because it's just like that's what you would do, and that keeps you in the rhythm of making sure that you're being polite.
I'm 100% with you, 100%.
But he didn't like it at all. He was just like, it's like thanking the garbage can. I'm like, I know, but I mean, like, you know, the garbage can didn't talk to me.
Yeah, exactly. Time. Yeah, yeah. The garbage can told me.
Didn't answer me a question. You know, didn't tell me, you know, how old, you know, Sabalenka is.
Right.
I wanted to know how old Aryna Sabalenka is. The garbage can ain't going to tell me, you know?
Yeah, it's very true, man. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I feel all sorts of ways about this, right? Like,
I bet.
I think I am a little bit jaded because of the way the internet developed, like I said earlier on, right? Like, I had really high hopes for it. And then it got kind of coerced, you know, it became, rather than like an interesting and fun frontier where, you know, nerds would hang out and, you know, make web pages for each other or share their projects or whatever, it's become largely a corporate place, you know, and so I was actually working on a project recently. Do you know what an AI agent is?
Yes, I do know what it is. Okay. But you wanted to explain it.
Yeah, anyway. Absolutely. So an AI agent, for people that haven't heard the term, is an AI that can take concrete action in order to fulfill a request or help you with a task. So it might be editing a file on your computer. It might be like reaching out to a search engine and doing a search to get information or, you know, data sheets or whatever. And there are lots and lots of applications of this. There's, you know, just so much ongoing research. And there's actually a kind of a protocol called the Model Context Protocol that is meant to allow AI agents to reach out to more and more different services, like, you know, your ticket keeping program, your accounting program, your, you know, all that kind of stuff. Then now the AI can connect to that.
Even up to like booking tickets to you know, an airplane.
Yep, 100%.
Like a trip, it can help you facilitate an entire vacation.
Right, but the vast majority of agents that are available right now. So you know, like the newer ChatGPT modes, like the thinking mode, that's kind of an agentic experience. But all of these things are filtered through, you know, like a corporate overlord. Like, you don't own the agent. You don't own the AI. You don't own the code. You know, like, no one's really going to take responsibility for its actions, right? They're going to be like, oh, it does something harmful. Like, oh, it, you know, you ask it to book you tickets to Costa Rica and it books them to Russia or something instead for you. You know, the AI and or ChatGPT, they're not going to take responsibility for that. So I do think that it's a place where like the ownership matters. You know, I want individuals to be, you know, the owners of AI agents. So I started a project and I actually wrote myself an AI agent, which I'm probably going to release open source as basically like a portfolio piece. You know, it's not as good as what OpenAI or Anthropic can do because I'm just one guy and not, you know, 7,000 people with a 10 billion in capital.
Right.
But, you know, I do think that ownership aspect is super important.
I guess, you know, we talk a lot, actually, on this podcast, you know, we talk about how AI has changed the way people look at art. And AI art has become an issue that, and I'm totally against it. Like, I'm to the point where when, you know, you start to see, you know, the internet, the social media has allowed people to kind of get rid of public relations firms, you know, for the most part, or belittle them to a certain degree.
Right.
Public relations firms have had to pivot to figure out ways in which they can be relevant. And it's usually not on social media. It's usually, you know, based on personal connections and stuff like that. But the AI art has become this thing where people are like, I need to create a logo. and then they'll use ChatGPT to create a logo, and then the AI will, you know, if you say, I want it to look like this, I want it to look like that, I want it to look like that, let's just say the logo from the, you know, Washington Commanders football team.
Right.
And then, so then that'll be the information to get to that logo is kind of your take. It's taken from, you know, existing artists and art and stuff like that.
Yep.
So there's this weird, there's this strange feeling of, you know, talking about ownership is who owns these styles and ideas.
Yeah. Yeah. And like the ownership of individual art pieces is like, you know, I think that's pretty nailed down. Like, you know, if you make a giant lure, you own the, you know, the image rights to that giant lure and so on. But yeah, like, do you own the rights to that style? Like, remember when the epoxy river tables, like, you know, there was like one artist that made them, right? And then all of a sudden next week there's like 5,000 artists that make them.
Yeah. Well, look at knife makers.
Yeah.
I mean, knife makers are like, they think that, I call them, you know, half of them Christopher Columbus Jr. You know,
I made this. Yeah. Oh, they think no,
that,
you didn't.
I mean, they think that they've, you know, they think they've discovered everything.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Yeah, I don't know why. Like, you can pick this apart if you like, but I have less objection to automating like the design of a logo. I don't especially feel a strong way about that. But then you're talking about like people's creative outlet, like, you know, painting, art, you know, the really personal art styles, that all of a sudden that is being devalued.
Right.
You know, so we're using automation to devalue, like, human expression. You know, that hurts me a lot more than, you know, like, I think of, like, a logo. It's kind of like by corporation for corporation, or, you know, business for business.
Well, that's just a small example of,
yeah. Yeah,
of how they're done.
But, yeah, I feel much more strongly about the, like, how it's devaluing personal creativity and self-expression.
I guess I feel, and I know that one of our listeners who's listening to this now is probably, as as I'm speaking, is probably furiously typing at me. Mark Adams, who's this he's been on the podcast a few times, incredible photographer, and he and I hate AI art, because especially with photographers, there's this major theft of, you know, people's work. In my opinion, I think it's like a slippery slope where if you start to accept a little bit of it, it's an easy way for you to it being accepted for everything. Like, I remember, you know, there was like a Facebook trend a few years ago where people would put their picture in and then it would kind of turn them into some sort of like character from Dune or something like that. And all of a sudden these really, like, you know, people were just, you know, sending these, you know, these beautifully animated selfies of themselves that obviously made them look way better and they way cooler. And it was just like, all I could think of is like, who stole this style from Frank Frazetta, or who stole this style from whatever? And there's just like, there's this, I find it to be odious and I'm completely against it. And the funniest part is usually that, like, we talk about this on Knife Talk, knife makers are just like, what are you talking about? And a lot of it's because they're not artists who've been stolen from, you know, some of them are. And I think that it gets to the point where, you know, somebody, I wrote something and somebody said, well, you know, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. And I said, well, finish the quote. That the quote isn't just that. It's like of, you know, someone, I have to get it, but it's basically like, it's a
little
bit.
Yeah, I don't know the rest of the quote. You got to tell me the rest of the quote.
All right, just start talking and I'll find it.
Yeah,
I'll tell you in a second. Just start vamping about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard too, because like if you crack open an AI, you know, an image generation AI, like the sources aren't in there. Like you can't prove in any way that, you know, this particular artwork was like ingested as training data. Like you could ask it to reproduce it and see how close it gets and take that as evidence, I guess. But, and yeah, I struggle with this a little bit too, because, you know, I, as a knife maker, saw many other knife makers' work before I started making knives.
Yes, of course.
And that information is in my brain. Like I didn't like mean to, you know, take anyone's like elements of design or whatever, but I know I did, the same as every other artist and designer before me. So yeah, it's hard.
Well, let's get into that, but the full quote is from Oscar Wilde, and it's, mm-hmm. imitation is the sincerest form of flattery that mediocrity can pay to greatness. Now, that is like a that is a bit of a smash in the face, but the funny part is we've taken half the quote away, mm-hmm. to make it a little bit like, hey, it's not so bad. You know, you should be flattered, you know, instead of, you know.
Have you heard the other one, like good artists copy, great artists steal?
Yeah, you know, well.
Is there a rest of that?
That I don't know. I'm not going to start digging up quotes. I mean,
the show is going to be called Jeff Googles Things.
Why don't you just get your AI agent to help us out with these quotes that are not complete?
Yeah.
You know? But I mean, I think it's funny. You should talk. At some point, people are just like, you got Aaron Goff on. You're not talking about knife making. I think that the interesting part is that, and I think that there's like an analog quality to being a human. Mm-hmm. That a lot of times, especially a creative person, you don't get it exactly where you want it the first time.
No.
There's usually experience is getting a strong understanding of where you're supposed to go, but along the way, you have a series of hurdles and mistakes that you have to kind of like recognize, mm-hmm. and make sure you don't do it again.
Mm-hmm.
So in my opinion, the way my knives have progressed, a lot of it's based off of mistakes I've made in the past, efficiencies that I've tried to make sure that I'm more efficient.
Yep.
I've used technologies to, you know, instead of just using a rasp to carve out my handle, I'm using grinders, I'm using different grinders, I'm using different procedures on the grinders to kind of make me more efficient.
Yep.
But it all comes from a sense of experience. And it seems as though technology, let's bring it to the knife making, is allowing people to sidestep experience. And what I hear from a lot of knife makers, and actually, you know, I just posted this. We got to talk about how, you know, the internet, how social media has changed the way we value certain things too.
Right.
But what I was making a point of, I made a short 20-second meme. It was like made to be fake. You know, there's this thing where in Goodfellas where Robert De Niro is like looking at down the bar, and he looks like he's going to be, you know, he's addressing something, he's looking at something, and you know, the cogs are spinning.
Mm-hmm.
And then Martin Scorsese puts the Cream song, White Room, you know, the classic Cream song, the name's escaping me. And then I did that same thing, and I wrote is when knife makers ask me how to make serrations, and then they start making my knives. And it was more along the lines of what I find from most knife makers who have learned off the internet, watching your videos or DMing people, is they're less likely to invest in their experience of making their own mistakes, and they want their hand held so they don't lose money or time.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, time especially is like, can you name a more valuable commodity? I don't know.
Experience. I mean, time is experience. I almost feel as though making mistakes and trying to leapfrog them so you don't make the same mistakes is almost as valuable as anything else. Because now it's like saying thank you to the chat, you know, Siri. It's like, I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to keep my discipline and then I'm going to learn from it.
Yeah. You know, the example that jumps to mind for me is folks that just read a heat treat recipe and follow it.
Right.
Rather than, you know, experimenting with the variables with your equipment, you know, verifying the results, testing the results, and developing that experience and expertise around metallurgy that comes from that. You know, just copying a recipe is a job kind of half done. But at the same time, I also would argue like a beginner knife maker has so many things to learn that sometimes stuff just needs to get pushed off to later, you know? And I do think that that is a large part of why new people especially will copy, because you know, everything else is daunting enough. Like, you know, if you're to tell someone like, oh, you want to make a knife? Well, first you've got to design an original design from the ground up. Now you've got to learn how to implement it without like being able to reference the way that anybody else implements their designs, you know? There's a balance there for sure.
I don't mean to say that every knife has to be You know, there's no way, you know, Craig Lockwood used to say there's only so many things you can make that are point and sharpie, sharp and pointy.
Yep.
But I think it's the development of your process and then your final outcome. Yep. What's interesting about you is you're a whole duality. Your whole situation with Goff Customs is a duality. Because, I mean, we've been talking for 50 minutes and you're incredibly well-versed in terms of, you know, obviously technology and computers and AI and all this stuff. But at the same time, you really have not sidestepped all the hard work to develop your knife. I mean, your knife, the Resolute Mark, what are we on, Mark 4 now or Mark 3?
The Mark 4 is actually moving forward. So Mark 3 still, and
I got mine. I got my
you
two.
Did.
I got. You're the only person I bought two exact, almost exact same knives from. And I will tell you this. It's fucking impressive. The Mark III is unbelievable. Resolute Mark III is unbelievable. But the amount of time and energy you have invested to get to where you are now is, I'm going to say, staggering. Because you really, like you were just talking about the heat treatment. I mean, if you watch the videos on Goff Custom, you've no rock has been unturned in regards to how you do your projects.
Yeah, and honestly, it's kind of daunting. Like, I want to change steel, right? I want to change from A2 to AEBL. But, does that mean that I have an obligation to go through and do that same level of re-exploration? Or am I at the point where I can just be like, I kind of know what's going on here. I can just make the switch and people should just trust me that it's good. You know, there's this baggage that comes along with this approach, right? And, in the tech world, in the business world, we'd call that the first mover disadvantage. You know, the first company that, commercially, because it had been done before, but the first company that commercially did a vertical landing of a rocket was SpaceX. And then everyone was telling them the whole time, that's stupid. Yeah, that's just a dumb idea. Don't even try it. Everyone knows that can't be done. And then they did it, and everyone's like, oh, wow, that's a great idea. We should all do it. Hmm. You know, so to some extent, we're all standing on the shoulders of giants, and I don't know where flattery turns into just riding someone's coattails. If that makes sense.
I wish that standing on the shoulders of giants was that's only half the quote, Aaron.
Give me the other half.
The other half is standing on giants with very small penises. I want that to be I want all these quotes to be only half of them, and then we just kind of have these absurd endings.
Well, just lie. The internet, you can lie as much as you want on the internet now. Go make it up.
Speaking of the internet, I was, and you were talking about back in the whole situation about how Facebook is, turned into, or Facebook, or people's information is so skewed. Mm-hmm. And this might be random for everybody else, but everyone, I think that a lot of people know that I'm a giant Howard Stern fan.
Okay.
And he was off for the summer, and there were these rumors going around that he was going to get fired. And there were rumors going around that he was, not going back with SiriusXM, and all these rumors, and just crazy rumors. And he just went on 2 hours before we started recording. I came to the shop an hour earlier than I normally would because I wanted to hear what he had to say live.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, the state of journalism is so bad that anybody can postulate a rumor and these news organizations just run with it. Run with it. And he says it was so crazy that all the mainstream media and all these different, even not mainstream media, the stories they were going with, and it was an embarrassment, really.
Right.
But what's interesting was it seemed as though, and this is something to do with, when I said that I did this quick reel where I, the most volume I get of views I get on Instagram are when I say something relatively controversial.
Yep.
And it gets to the point where that the commodity now is engagement.
100%.
So not only do, good or bad, we're not looking at likes anymore. We're looking at views.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's probably the same on YouTube. I would imagine I don't do YouTube.
Yeah, but I refer to this as perverse incentive.
Exactly, right.
Theoretically, making content for you should be about, introducing people to your business and showcasing your work. But, just doing that in a straightforward way isn't what gets you the best result. So you have a perverse incentive to be inflammatory, to be confrontational, to be, you know, hyperbolic, rather than just being, you know, quote unquote boring and showing it how it is, right? And I do think that that's a big part of how we've ended up here.
Well, this is so not only does it work within the confines of just social media personalities, and let's just put everybody in the concept that everybody's a personality now, but it's like news now gets, you know, they can, if you get people to click on the link, or you get people to watch the show, you get people to you know, everyone's now, they're doing their clips on Instagram so the views can go, you know, viral, whatever.
Yep.
So then all of a sudden it's the, you show the engagement and you have the metrics of the engagement and whether or not it's correct or it isn't correct, people are watching because they're looking for that degree of perversion.
Yeah.
You know, and we're using perversion in a very loose way.
Right.
But it's madness because, like, you know, it's this really sad state of affairs that now I'm having, and a lot of knife makers are in the same boat, is a lot of knife makers have given up. But the problem is when I post, I can see based off of our, you know, shopping platform that I can see people going to the website in droves based on what I post and what I think people want to know.
Yep.
And it's becomes this, like, you know, when you have a business, I got, you know, four employees, then, you know,
four employees now,
well,
man?
I'm one of those employees.
Oh, that's amazing.
And then my other employee is my business partner who's been with me for 10 years.
Right.
And I get someone in the shop and then someone in the office.
Right.
So it's like, I mean,
good
I'm
on
not,
you, man. It, honestly, but, like, people don't understand how hard of a slog it is to get
well,
done, you know,
that's a different conversation.
It is.
But the idea is that I have to activate this perverse what?
Perverse incentive.
Perverse incentive. I have to use this perverse incentive. I have to attack the knife making community.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would
in order
argue
to get 20,000 views.
Yeah, I would argue the perverse incentive is for you. It's hidden in there, right? Because
I get the visual effect of how it does. I mean, that's the same thing with OnlyFans, really.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a very straightforward incentive. Like, you know, I show you things I'm not going to show the world at large,
right,
and you give me money.
Yeah. And you're just going to have to trust me. You have to pay for it, and then you're going to have to trust me.
Yeah. I think the perverse incentive comes in when it's like, you know, I could make a straightforward video that, like, shows people exactly how to do a part of my process. Or I could do, you know, I could adopt this persona and be a wacky YouTube presenter,
right,
and my engagement would go up.
Right.
Right. So I have a perverse incentive there to be someone other than who I am. And I think a lot of people get trapped in that.
They do. I mean, I don't know. I've had Alex Steele on here years ago when I first started, and I had a really great conversation. If you go back in the archives, he is not the Alex Steele that you know from when he's on the podcast. He's very, very normal, you know, like a normal person. He's not animated. He's not, you know, he doesn't have, you know, he's just a normal guy. And I've had conversations with him where he is a regular, not, you know, performative guy.
Right. Yeah.
It's tough. It's hard.
It is.
It's hard. And he's a real person. And, you know, I think these things become overwhelming, I'd imagine.
Honestly, like, I feel very, very tired of social media, of YouTube, of Instagram. You know, like, I don't open Instagram as an app anymore. Because, you know, like, so this is hard to explain. I really enjoy taking people on the journey with me and helping them learn and teaching them stuff and, you know, like sharing those moments with them. But it's kind of gotten to the point where I have a perverse incentive. I'm not sharing because I'm motivated to share. I might be feeling like I have to share in order to keep the business rolling.
Right.
Right.
That's right. That's how I feel.
Yeah. And, you know, like, it kind of pigeonholes you. It's not a great feeling. I've been honestly spending a fair bit of time, like, looking at that and trying to work out, like, how can I reclaim that that relationship for myself, like that relationship that I have with the videos and the content that I make. But yeah, you know, it's just not as fun as it used to be, because I really feel like you have to be, you know, on Instagram, you have to be careful. Are you showing a knife? Oh, that's, you know, that'll get you like demonetized or well, hidden, you know?
I've hit some loopholes on that.
I'm not really,
I don't buy into that anymore.
Right.
But
yeah, I think the relationship there has become a lot more complicated than it used to be.
For me, it's always been, you know, I couldn't have built Fader Knives without, you know, social media. So mm-hmm. And then I've seen a direct result. I've also, you know, a month or so ago, my sister passed away, and I noticed that I'm doing what we call sitting Shiva, what the Jewish people call sitting Shiva. Mm-hmm. I left social media alone for like 7 days.
Right.
And I did notice a definite decline in sales and traffic to the website because I wasn't on there.
Yep.
Now, I never felt like I need to be a persona.
Right.
Like, I'm
your persona very, enough as it is.
I'm very much already Larry David. I'm Larry David Jr. I've always have been. I always will be. And I figure just keep going. And if I think something's funny or I enjoy it, then I do it. I'm not brainstorming to figure out ways in which to do things. I am fooling around with new apps to do green screens. I think that's kind of funny, and I do things that I'm not spending as much time as you'd think. And it, to me, if it's engaging enough to me to keep doing, then that's good enough for you.
Right.
And what happens is I see the value on the website. I see the traffic. So it's just like data is there's proven data, and it's like I also believe that everything's a marathon, not a sprint.
Yes.
And I would rather I don't like to have high highs and low lows. I'd be right down the middle. Mm-hmm. And that's where I've been with steady, slow but steady growth for the 11 years I've been doing this. 10 years.
I have a lot of respect for that. Sustainability is something that businesses don't practice as much as they should. And I don't mean like, oh, green sustainability. I mean like, you know, not turning into a flaming puddle of goo because you're just working too hard.
Not bouncing checks and not telling your employees cash your check until next week. And yeah, I don't want to do that. And I've been very fortunate that we've been at that point where, you know, giving myself a pat on the back, but everything is a slow burn. And it's funny, you know, it's funny mm-hmm. too, is because I feel like, and this is a little off topic, but I think it's similar. I believe, and this could be just me being, you know, understanding that everything's hard and you should allow things to be hard and mm-hmm. there's no, you know, easy answers and, you know, everything takes time and we have this terrible idea of lack of patience in general. I feel like Ozempic is the perfect, and these whatever variations of Ozempic, is the perfect medicine for today's humanity. Because it just adds on to the idea that you don't need experience in which to get to your destination. You don't need the hard work and toil. And we now have this product that it's the miracle drug. Not only is it you're gonna lose weight, but if you're diabetic, it's good for you, good for your heart. And as last week we found out, it makes your dick bigger, believe it or not.
That and they also use it for alcoholism and other substance issues. Like apparently it reduces people's drive.
Is a miracle drug.
Yeah.
And it is the perfect, when I'm saying perfect, it's almost like a joke. It's like this cosmic joke that this is the same. This medication, which, and I'm not, if you're on it, God bless you. Good for you. I'm with you. And I'm just saying that it's almost like the perfect allegory or illusion. Not illusion. It's like the perfect drug for modern day time right now.
Yeah, I feel so two ways about this.
Go ahead.
Because, so I have a career in software development that I, you know, built over a long period of time. And a lot of the way that I built that is through portfolio pieces. And so I would write, you know, software that was useful or interesting for me, and then I'd release it as open source so other people can use it for free. So like, I got a benefit, and I'm helping, like, drive civilization forward, if that makes sense. So, like, I don't want to feel salty about people that are, like, using that output, that thing that I made, without having to, like, learn all of the, you know, have all the pain that I had to experience to write that code.
Right.
You know, that's kind of where I come back to, like, standing on the shoulders of giants. Like, I think we all have to acknowledge that we do that, and maybe we should contribute back. But yeah, where's the line? You know, if I can just, like, lie in bed all day while an AI agent, like, does my job, should I do it?
All right, here's the line. Let's just say Aaron Goff has got, he's got no more ice storms. He's on the internet, and he decides one day, you know what? I'm gonna open up my Instagram and see what's going on. And then you see a high school. Oh no, you're gonna Facebook. You're gonna open up. You're gonna see a high school friend who, in entire life, was obese. Mm. This person's online, lost a ton of weight. There's a ton of weight. And says, I was on Ozempic, and look what I did. Look what I did to myself. Look how I've fixed myself. Mm-hmm. Look how I fixed myself. Are you going to say, congratulations? And are you going to think to yourself, that must have been a lot of hard work? Or are you going to be like, what are you looking for? Congratulations. What do you want? You want a pat on the back?
I don't know. Yeah, I think one of the things that, as I've gotten older, I think one of the things I've realized is, like, every situation is black and white. So, like, someone saying, like, oh yeah, really? I lost a ton of weight. Sorry, not every situation is black and white.
Oh, my opposite, God. I'm opposite. Like, everything for me, it's a gray area.
Yeah, yeah. No, no. I'm never going to claim everything's black and white. That was misspeech.
Like, oh, my God. Now we are officially a real podcast.
No, everything's gray. You know, like,
yeah.
Someone that's taking Ozempic to lose weight, like, it's likely that that's not, like, their first attempt at doing that.
Right.
And there's a lot of pain and struggle that comes along with, like, trying and failing, you know? Like,
I believe you.
Yeah. And I say this as someone that's, like, or at least when I weighed myself around Christmas, I was, like, 212, you know? And, you know, I used to train Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, like, 12 hours a week. I was, like, shredded and six-pack and all that. And I've just let myself go, you know? So I recognize that there's a lot of, like, there's a lot of work and battle and whatever that has to go into even acknowledging that you've reached that point. So, like, someone that has started taking Ozempic, they've taken action. They've taken an action to try and help make their life better. And I honestly applaud that.
You know what? You just changed my opinion.
Ha! Gotcha.
You did a good job. You did a good job. That was very good. Because my wife thinks that I'm fat phobic, and I believe I probably am. And a lot of that has to do with, I've seen the decline in health of family members who were very close to me, who, because of their inaction in regards to their health, have put themselves and the family in a position of real sadness because of the decisions that they've made or lack of decisions that they've made.
Yep.
So I probably have some sort of unreasonable expectation on people of saying, that's why, I mean, I'm running the New York City Marathon in 8 weeks. I've been, like, since the pandemic, I've been, like, I ran the marathon 12 years ago, and then I'm doing it again in 8 weeks, and I'm really, like, working hard and really, really putting me, and it's a fucking struggle, and it hurts, and it's just, like, it's just hard, but I'm going to do it. And I feel as though maybe it's like this weird subconscious equation of, like, you're not willing to work hard enough for other people, and you want to be a burden. So like that, and that's unrealistic on my that's unrealistic and relatively cruel for me to be that way, but I'm admitting it. And you've made me see the light, Aaron Goff.
Well, I don't know about that, but maybe I've added another perspective. Let's just say,
because I'm going to get the messages saying, oh man, you are an asshole. I want you all to know I was an asshole, and then Aaron Goff squared me away, and now I'm not an asshole.
I don't know, man. I think the biggest thing I've learned is just, like, life's hard, man. Life's hard. Everyone's dealing with stuff that they're not openly communicating with others about, you know? So, like, someone struggling with weight, there's probably 10,000 other things that are, you know, feel bigger or more important.
You are right, but I have 3 hours of a week of podcasting.
That you have to talk shit in, yeah.
Hey. I'm kind of in this position where me talking about things is slightly important, and I try to say something that other people aren't saying. I'm looking for not just regurgitating what I hear from other people.
Yeah. That's
so making that point is, but at the same time, I'm always willing to be wrong. And I think that what you've said is completely right. And honestly, does it really matter to me if someone lost a lot of weight on Instagram and then they say, look what I did? Do I care? I'll say something to my wife. I'll say, like, look at this.
Maybe
look at this
care
shit.
A tiny bit then.
Look at this shit. Look at that. Look at all the work they've done taking Ozempic. Right. Look at all the work they've done. And then she'll say, you know, that's a horrible thing to say. And I'll be like, what are you talking about? She's like, maybe it was very hard for them. Maybe you had a glandular issue. Maybe they have a, you know, real mental problems or something like that. Or
what's your wife's name again?
What's wrong with you? What, pardon me?
What did you say your wife's name was again?
Hillary.
Good job, Hillary. You fucking tell him.
She would, number two, she would never be on this podcast or listen to it. So I don't have to worry about that, but I've never really, I know this is a fact.
Yeah. Well, but so, you know what? You were willing to be wrong.
I'm always willing. I don't care. I'm totally willing to be wrong. I'd have no problem. I'm thrilled when I'm wrong. I'm thrilled to say, you know what? You make a good point. I don't feel. I don't feel like it's some sort of like, you know, check mark against who I am. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. Great. Fantastic. Right. I don't care.
Yeah. And, you know, I honestly think that's a super important thing because, like, taking your own opinions as like an integral part of your personality and then reacting like someone's attacking you when they, you know, try to correct one of your opinions or something you said. It's just counterproductive, man. We're all wrong. We're all
wrong. Of course. Of course. It's like, you know what? It's like everybody. I'm not running for office. I'm not like all of a sudden my decisions that I make affect you. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I'm perfectly happy to be wrong. You know?
It's a healthy outlook.
Well,
I respect
it. What are you going to do? Last question. Last question.
Hit me.
How are tariffs affecting golf customs?
You want to know the real answer?
Well, no, I have an idea what the real answer is, but go ahead.
The real answer is I have no fucking idea.
Oh, okay.
Because how can anyone have any idea? It might be different tomorrow. It was different last week.
It was a lot different last year. Last week was a lot different. You know, when this $800 de minimis exemption was just stripped away, and now things coming in, you know, and their countries, you know, Australia isn't using their postal service. They're pausing shipping United States because they can't figure it out.
Yep. Yeah. And you know what, man, I was so stressed about this at the start of the year. So like I have a therapist. I think that's a great thing. It's like having an oil change for your car, you know, like
amazing.
Having an external opinion. Fantastic. I've seen the same therapist for 12 years.
A
I hadn't
human?
Seen her.
Yeah, a human or an AI agent?
Yeah, she's a human, as far as I'm aware.
Look at you. See, you're a real good person. You're not going to an AI agent for your therapy. I'm proud of you.
Well, I'll do a little bit of both.
I'll bet you will. I bet you will.
But, like, I was like, you know, hey, I think I need to start having, like, monthly sessions. I'm stressed as shit right now. And you know what was the trigger for that? Tariffs.
Really?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I'm in Canada. Most of my customers are in the U.S.,
right.
Tariffs being enacted in the wrong way, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Will kill my business. Full stop.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've made so much effort to buy from U.S. Like material suppliers and stuff over the year. My entire supply chain goes through the U.S. And that's very deliberate because I wanted to support the people that were buying my knives. And then all of a sudden, I'm hit with tariffs on the way in. I'm hit with tariffs on the way out. And they might change tomorrow. So, yeah, you know, like the real salty answer here is I don't fucking know. I don't know how they affect my business.
This is the biggest issue because, you know, obviously, what I'm worried about is I'm worried about steel scarcity, especially in the United States, because now we're in a position where most of the stainless steel that I use comes from Germany or Sweden.
Yep.
And there's a large amount of steel that's in the United States, you know, that's already pre-tariffed, you know, before the tariffs were in place.
Yep.
And when that supply goes, you know, all of a sudden the price of everything going up 50% from, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And my fear is that bigger companies are going to also have known this, and then they're just going to swipe up all that steel that was, you know, that was a stockpile because they know they got to make it through 2026.
Yep.
And then small companies especially will be like, well, it doesn't pay for us to get a pallet of AEBL because we can't afford it. We don't necessarily know if we're going to sell it with this price.
100%. And you know what? Like, I'm not speaking from a place of judgment here, just from a place of business reality. I have to, as a sane business person, well, mostly sane, I have to look at moving my supply chains outside of the US.
Right.
So like right now, you know, my steel distributors get their steel from Europe, then it's processed in the US, it's precision ground, and then it's sent to me. But that last step, which I felt was really important, now exposes me to a ton of risk. So like the only rational outcome here for a business in my situation is to remove that risk. You know, and that's very sad for all the people in the US that have built businesses around trying to supply people for like myself, you know?
I went to your website and you write in where everything comes from. You get all your yep. G10 from Alpha, you get all these, and yep. it's like, it's the whole thing is like, I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday. My high school friend is a Wall Street guy. He's been on Wall Street for 30 years. Mm. And he was asking, we check in every so often. We've been friends for like, you know, fucking 40 years or something like that.
That's amazing.
He'd been there for 30 years in Wall Street. So he's, right. you know, he said to me,
he's seen some shit at this point.
Yeah. I mean, he was there during 9/11. So like, kind of like, he has got a very you know, big grasp of what's going on. And he said to me 6 months ago, he called me up. He says, just be careful. Hmm. He says, because there's going to be 6 months ago, he said, there's going to be a lot of economic uncertainty. And he pointed to this, the numbers from a gourmet dog food company. People were killing it. This gourmet dog food company was killing it.
Right.
And then as soon as people started to get nervous, they started to take away their luxury items. And yep. the numbers from this gourmet dog food company went like shit the bed, because people were just like, all right, we're going back to Purina. And yep. we're going, the boy's getting puppy chow, yep. you know? And he says, this signals to us that people are really going to be spending less money on luxury items. And he said to me, just be nimble and be mm-hmm. financially flexible. And to the point where I ended up buying some pre-tariff steel twice. I bought, I bought knives, you know, before I normally would have. And then I bought like 8 sheets of steel, just put my name on it and keep it for a rainy day. Mm-hmm. Because I was concerned that, you know, what's going to happen in the next 6 months, 10 months.
Well, like, so I can buy AEBL directly from Europe if I buy enough. The right. minimum purchase is 5,000 pounds. And in the past, I've never considered that. And now I'm wondering whether that's the right thing to be doing, you know, like it's just, from my perspective, it's very, very frustrating. And, you know, like I said, like I went back to my therapist and I was like, oh my God, like help me, because it's incredibly emotionally damaging to, like, I've worked in my business for 15 years.
You put the time in.
Just blood. I'm not even, blood, sweat and tears, man. It's not even a hyperbole. I literally accidentally stuck a knife into my hand like a month ago, by the way. You know, like, and then to have the potential that my business would just be killed through no fault of my own. Oh, like, that's just soul crushing, man. It makes me just honestly want to not put the amount of effort in that I otherwise would.
Well, what did your therapist say, if you don't mind me asking?
She was basically like, yeah, you're right to be stressed. I don't know that you can do anything about any of that. And I was like, yeah, that's... It's so basically just acceptance.
You know what? If she's just going to mirror and label your problems, you should just might as well go to an AI chatbot.
Now Jeff's telling me I should get the AI therapy.
I mean, Aaron, I mean, I can tell. I can label and mirror your problems, too. That's mm-hmm. easy. Mm-hmm. It must be hard. It must be really hard. Yeah, you seem like you're really upset. The AI chatbot can do that. She got to work a little harder.
Dang.
For your money. You're getting that human experience. She got to be a little bit more nuanced.
It's just, yeah. I mean,
speaking of which, could you imagine if there were therapists that had the specialty of global economic trade information as part of their...
I'm sorry you feel that way, Aaron. As you know, under Section 31 of CUSMA, you can export... Yeah, come on.
That would be the craziest and the best add-on. He's like, not only is she a great therapist, but she knows all about international trade rules, laws, and expectations, and she's also a futurist.
I would pay double for that service right now.
Oh, I'm sure people already do. Like, I'm sure that there are people, like, you know, who are just like, I need someone who's really good at, you know, And you know, the exemptions and you know, the de minimis exemption X and whatever. Oh,
something just popped into my head.
Go ahead.
Okay. Jeff.
Yeah.
Out of all of the businesses that have to deal with this complexity, which ones do you think are the ones that are the best equipped?
Great question. From whose standpoint? Your standpoint or mine? Because as
I think we'll both have the same answer.
As a person in Canada and a person in the United States, it's going to be different.
I think actually we'll both have the same answer. At least for me, my answer is big businesses. The bigger, the better. Like, you can just have an entire person whose entire job it is it's just to learn everything about tariffs and to keep the company on its toes, you know, and in dealing right. with these situations. Whereas the little businesses, they can't do that. They're just getting squeezed out.
You are a million times right. Small businesses are the ones who are getting hurt by these tariff plans. And I was talking to my friend, and he was saying the same thing. It's the small guys. I mean, there are companies in the EU or in the UK that they're, you know, 70-80% of their business in the United States.
Yep.
And now that the Royal Mail isn't shipping the United States anymore, and, you know, they're having to deal with private shipping companies, mm-hmm. it's destroyed their business. Same thing with all these Australian knife makers. You know, Mert Tansu said, you know, all these Australian knife makers, like 70% of my business was in the United States.
Yep.
And now Australian Mail can't do it.
Yep. Yeah.
It's terrible.
It is terrible. I don't know what to say about it, honestly.
Well, I don't know what to say about it either. I was going to try to bring us up a little bit, but you know,
nah. Let's just be depressed and go about our day.
Hey, come on, man. Can't be depressed.
I've got to give my therapist money for something. Come on,
dude. I think you should let your therapist know. I'll tell you a funny story. You should let your therapist know I'm dissatisfied with him. So years ago, my mother is. And she is in a facility. She has really, like, you know, late stage dementia. And this isn't the jokey part.
No.
And when I see her, we have a nice conversation. This is probably of my entire life. This is the nicest she's ever been to me.
No.
So she doesn't necessarily know who I am. She thinks I'm her brother. And I don't mean, I've in my mind, I'm thinking this is going to be a funny story. And it just gets worse and worse. And this little, like, person in my head is saying, Jeff, you're getting worse. You're getting worse. Yeah, you're losing everybody. So when I was younger, she really got involved in the 80s. She got involved with therapy because, mm-hmm. you know, between the divorce of my father and everything like that. So there was – and then, you know, the divorce rate in the United States during the 80s was, like, insane. In New York, it was just insane. Like, it was an oddity for anybody to have married parents. Like, I always was just like, well, what's it like having married? You know, that was like, it was a total oddity. So, like, therapy and therapy talk was such a huge part of my upbringing.
Mm.
And my mother was going to group therapy. And she said something that I thought was like, that's crazy. That's a crazy thing to say. You know, I don't remember exactly what she said. I said, you know, you really are losing, you know, you're really like wasting your money in this group therapy session.
Okay.
She had the nerve to say, well, do you want to know what they think about you? As if she was telling them all about me.
Right.
And she was telling them all about me. She's like, she said, and it was, you know, I don't know, I necessarily think she was trying to be hurtful, but she's like, well, do you want to know what they said about you? And I stopped the conversation. I said, you can tell them. They can all line up and they can all bend over and kiss my ass or something like that. I think I said they can suck my dick. I think I was so incensed. I said they can all can suck my dick as far as I'm concerned. If you really, that's how you stop a conversation with your mother.
Yeah,
where you
absolutely.
Tell them all these people in your group therapy, they can all suck my dick. You know, and it was like, it was the end of the conversation. I never found out what they thought about me, but at the same time I thought, yeah, you know what? All of a sudden, I'm telling you, like, you know, you got to tell your therapist they're doing it right. And then next time I talk to you, you're going to tell me, you know, Jeff, you know what my therapist has to say about you?
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
Listen.
I'm listening.
I'm glad that there are people like you in the world.
Well, thank
Number
you.
One, your videos helped me become a better knife maker. I watched your videos back in the day when I was a sculptor and I was making forged knives and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And your knives helped me realize that you can make very high precision knives that don't look like a caveman made them.
Yep.
That's when my first knives were forged knives, and people were like, "Whoa, what's up, caveman?" I didn't, obviously, now that that's more, you know, sought after, but you have really, what you have done for the knife making community is anything short of, I mean, it's just like, you're a hero.
Well, thank you.
As far as I'm concerned.
So what I'm hearing, my job is done. I don't have to make any more YouTube content. Is that what you're saying?
Dude, I miss all your content. I miss all that. I miss your content. I was really excited. You had this teaser that you had gone to culinary school and you were going to test out the Triumvirate.
Oh my God, that knife is still in progress, man. I still work on it.
Whoa. And I hope my name is on the tester
of course
list, because of course. I want to try. And I'll never forget, there was, I don't know where it was, but there's a little bit of time lapse video of you, and you got the chef's hat on, mm-hmm. all the way up to the top. It's a crispy chef's hat, and you're cutting up something, and I'm just like, my man is about to take over.
One year, if I ever actually make the kitchen knife, yeah, maybe.
Oh, it looks awesome. I don't remember you. Maybe you sent me a picture of it or something, or maybe you posted a picture of it. Looks so cool.
Well, thank you. Yeah, honestly, so we moved out from the city to the country, and right. I was like, oh yeah, this workshop just needs a little bit of work. You know, the greatest lie I've ever told myself.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, I actually haven't talked about this. I actually just finished a batch of pre-orders that I ended up working on for 18 months.
Wow.
And I cannot tell you the damage that did to my mental health.
Oh, I bet.
Because the first 12 months of that, you know, I was like, yeah, I'll just finish the workshop real quick and then I'll get into the knives. Well, it turns out the first 12 months of that was finishing the workshop. And, you know, the more and more burnt out I felt, the more that the remaining work felt incredibly like daunting and just like too much weight to bear. So yeah, it's been a wacky time. And I think that a lot of those emotions have gotten mixed up in making content. You know, it puts up a real psychological barrier to just
doing
it.
And it slows everything. It slows everything down.
Yeah.
Like, your videos are so really well thought out, and I know how much time it takes. I mean, assuming I know how much time it takes.
Have a guess. Like average.
I'm not going to guess, but I just know that like when you film content of what you're doing,
yeah,
it slows everything down like 3 or 4 times.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I would say just editing, like a 12-minute video, I would say I have between 40 and 80 hours of editing.
Oh my God.
Like, I'm filming as I work, so you fill up SD cards with footage. You know, sometimes I'll have like 500 gigs of footage, which could be a dozen hours, you know, and then you have to condense that down to 12 minutes and have it make sense. It is a very tiring process that requires a lot of energy. And honestly, over the last couple of years, I just haven't had the energy. So hopefully now that the shop is in a working state and I've, you know, gotten the pre-orders out, hopefully that'll change.
So here's what we've learned.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron Goff needs a shrink that not only knows therapy,
but tariffs
and
as well.
Better than the basic therapy of mirroring and labeling. Anybody can do that.
Uh-huh.
But you also need a therapist that understands economic trade policy,
mm-hmm.
and machining.
And AI, CNC. Probably. Yeah.
And AI.
Yep.
Can you imagine if that was like, I mean, see, then all of a sudden you're going to figure out your AI agent is going to be, you know, you're going to figure out like, I need the therapist to have all these attributes. And then Aaron Goff is back to, you know, shooting out the cannon.
Who knows, man? Who knows? It's been a really challenging couple of years, honestly. And it's been rewarding to work through it. And it's fun to talk about it. But like, yeah, we'll have to see. My relationship with knife making and with making videos, I think, has to change to be more sustainable. And that's something I'm working on now. So,
well, you have you know that you have carte blanche here. So, like, anytime you want to come on, don't wait for me to ask.
I'll message because, you. Like, Jeff, I need therapy. Let's do a podcast.
Yeah, dude, I'm your man. This was awesome. I really appreciate your opinions in regard. I think that you're one of the smarter minds in knife making. You're in my top five favorite knife makers. There's no question about it.
I appreciate you, man.
No,
I don't know. I think, honestly, I think a lot of this stuff is just like symptoms of my involuntary hyperfocus on things. Mm. Like I'll get locked into something and I won't be able to put it down. Like literally when I was working on the AI agent, I like contacted my day job and I was like, yo, I need like a week off. I can't stop thinking about this thing. I have to get it out of my brain. So I literally took a week off and just spent the whole week coding.
Jeez. Look at you.
Yeah, for better or for worse, man.
Dude, you are the man. I love talking to you. I love hearing your perspective. I think that, you know, it's very helpful to a lot of people, including me. And the listeners, I know that I get a lot of messages in regards to when you come on, you know, a lot of those old school Aaron Goff Custom YouTube guys are just like fired up. So you have an open, you know, don't wait for me to contact you.
Yeah, I appreciate you.
Come on by.
Appreciate you. It was fun.
Guys, Aaron Goff, Goff Customs. In the show notes, you will have a direct link to his YouTube page, his Instagram page. I don't know, you don't use him anymore, but you can send him this, you can cheer him up and send him some nice messages. And if you're a therapist who understands trade stuff and CNC, contact me and I'll be the AI agent to get him to Aaron.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, guys. Aaron, you are the man. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for being so just, you know, generous with your time and your thoughtfulness. And I appreciate you.
Appreciate you too, man. Thanks for having me.
Guys, we will see you next week. Thanks again.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. TNCs apply. In app only.
Trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers. At forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou. forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.